Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Eliza Osborne. I'm Deputy Director at The Armory Show, and we're delighted to be here today with Managing Director of Yield Street Athena Art Finance, Naomi Bagel, who is presenting this afternoon's virtual tour of the Halls McKay Gallery, located in Southampton, to all of us. And with that, we have the director and owner of the gallery, Warren Wallace, who's joined us, as well as Joseph Hart, the artist whose work is being featured today and whose work is in the public collections of SF MoMA, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and many others. So without further ado, I turn this over to Naomi. Thank you.
Well, we're so excited to keep our participation with The Armory Show during this crazy pandemic. And we're thrilled to launch it with a tour of the Halls McKay Gallery and with Joe Hart's exhibition. Just a couple of clearinghouses. If people have questions, please go to the Q&A. And Eliza and I will vet those questions and do as many as we can at the end of the tour. And or if you put them in the chat, we'll look at that too. It's just easier if you decide to do the Q&A. And just as a ramble into their exploration of the exhibition, I just find it like so fascinating that Ryan and Joe have known each other a long time. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, this all kind of started earlier in your careers as a conversation. And here we are back into this conversation, giving people a tour of how you, A, kind of began this friendship and what this whole exhibition means to both of you. So I will turn it over to both Ryan and Joe to continue on.
Thank you. I'm Ryan, the owner of Halls McKay Gallery. And I guess just briefly, Joe and I met at RISD in undergrad and have since then shared studio, shared apartment in New York, and then gone our separate ways and raising families. And almost 10 years ago, I was living out in East Hampton where my wife was working, and there's a huge history of art out here, and I was seeing some really exciting kind of funky art spaces showing contemporary work, as well as some more blue chip secondary market places showing work. But I wasn't seeing anything that kind of fit my network of artists. And just kind of on a lark with one of my friends from high school who had also lived out here, we were like, oh, wouldn't it be interesting to rent a barn and like give Joe Hart a solo show out here? And we started thinking about that. She was a curator. I was just an artist working out here. And there's no free space out here to give someone an art show. So once we realized we might have to pay a rent, we found a really nice space and just kind of got a 6-month lease. And now we're almost 10 years later and we represent 18 artists, and we just had Joseph's 4th solo show at the gallery. He was the 2nd show that we ever had. So we've been working together a long time, besides from knowing each other for a long time.
Yeah, our friendship goes back 25 years. We met in 1995, just to underscore how long that history is.
And that was really kind of the impetus for the gallery. Was it started with this kind of small group of people, mostly from RISD, though from being showing artists, a lot of relationships on the West Coast had developed. And it really was like, let's just kind of see what happens if we give these people proper shows out here and see how collectors respond.
Yeah, and my name's Joseph Hart, just to reiterate that. I'm the artist that has a show up at Hallsmere, or had it come down recently. But I think to set up the deeper conversation in the Q&A, there's a a short video tour of the gallery that we're all going to watch. Is now the time to play that, or is there more things that need to happen beforehand?
I think it'd be a good time to watch that, and then we can kind of take it from there.
Okay, here we go.
So this is the show that Joseph just had in our gallery.
Yeah, it's a mix. So my medium of choice is I make paintings and drawings primarily, and that's what you're seeing here. I typically work on paper, and these large works are all paintings on paper that have been mounted to the wall. I also make drawings, which you'll see that are in these small frames. It's pretty clear that there are drawings. But the name of the show is Unnameable, and I think the best way to describe why I came up with that is in the midst of a pandemic and a social justice movement happening globally, just before we opened the show, I was sort of at a loss for coming up with a clever title. And I was speaking to my wife, and I said, I don't know what I should call this show. It's kind of unnameable. And she said, well, there's your title right there.
Original group. Right, right.
Oh.
And could you describe the curatorial
audio.
Vision or programming that you do out here at Halsey McKay?
I get asked that a lot, and there's no real set thing. I would say that mostly I look for unique voices, that whatever it is, be it interior painting or textile based work or sculpture or abstraction or landscape, that artist brings something to that genre that no one else does, or does it in a way that I find to be particularly unique. Without any intention, there seems to be an emphasis on things that are really tactile, that are best enjoyed in person and reveal something in the gallery that they wouldn't just online. I think it's just a personal taste thing, but what can art do today that a digital outlet can't? And things that need to be seen in person can slow you down in a way that a great documentary on Netflix can't do. Which leads us to your show, which is highly tactile and a very inventive use of materials.
Yeah, I thought maybe a way to sort of introduce the show is to read the paragraph that I wrote for the press release. It's a short text, but it sort of sets things up. And then we can talk about some of the individual works. Each work begins on my studio floor. Disjointed and oversized sheets of paper are casually laid down, allowing me to labor from above and walk through, on, and around each primordial picture plane. With a flexible aesthetic strategy in mind, a graphite crayon in one hand and a handful of batter-like acrylic paint in the other, I intuitively scrawl out wayward gestures and line work, apply and smear paint, then rip out, reorient, and replace entire sections of the surface. In turn, problematic areas of one painting become zones of triumph in another. This system of upcycling is tweaked and fine-tuned, resulting in an aggregated harmony that sways between contrasting sensations, deliberate but chaotic, rageful and generous, awkward yet bizarrely graceful. Through these dualities, I want my work to be balanced but also a little off, aware of its imperfections and allowed to operate on multiple emotional planes. I want my paintings to be allegories for the complexities of life. And that's what I was thinking when I made these works.
And here we are.
And here we are. Yeah, we're sitting in the gallery.
So all right, Ryan.
I'm still in the gallery, but Joe is in New Hampshire.
Yeah. I thought before we talk a little bit about the show, we should underscore or let the audience know how to get a hold of you and how to visit the gallery, whether it's online or in person. Because I know hours are different under the pandemic and such. Can you share information about that?
Yeah, so you can always view all of our current and past exhibitions at halseymckay.com. I can be reached at ryan@halseymckay.com. And we do have fairly regular hours now. We're Thursday nights now, we're open from 5 to 8, where there's kind of a gallery walk out here now, because somehow this small beach town now has like 10 great galleries all on the same street. So from 5 to 8 on Thursdays, there's kind of like a stroll through. So we're always open then. And then we're open Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, 11 to 5 every day, and always by appointment. So those are some options.
And you're pretty responsive, too. I know you get back to people pretty quickly when they reach out, which I obviously is a smart thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, customer service really comes down at the end. Like, the artwork's great, but that's step one.
Yeah. I thought a good place to start this little conversation would be if we go back about 9 months to when we started talking about putting together this show. And we were sort of banging around a few ideas, and you had some artistic direction or a suggestion for me. Do you remember what that was?
Yeah, well, we're beginning your fourth solo show with us. And now, I mean, you have a pretty solid collector base. The work kind of sells on its own agenda. A lot of what the gallery had been doing in the early part of our 10 years was kind of getting everybody's work out there and their names out there and trying to generate sales as well as just general knowledge about the artists and kind of let everybody do what they want. And now it was kind of like, well, what would be good for someone that's approaching mid-career? And I just kind of said, like, do something really ambitious. Like, we've never done a show of all huge paintings that barely fit in the gallery or whatever you wanted to do. There was no super direction, but just kind of go nuts, really.
I remember you saying, be ambitious, be powerful, be impactful. And my response to that was to think about the making site-specific work. Those paintings were made to fit just so in that gallery, sort of floor to ceiling, and to kind of, at least the largest work was sort of designed so that a viewer had to walk down it to experience it, because the gallery is in such a shape where getting far away is one thing, but you have to kind of walk along it. And that was something that I really wanted to do. Maybe we should also talk about the challenges in producing a show in the midst of a pandemic. I know that was something we had to consider. Why don't you start with what it meant for you?
There was a lot to consider, because basically my subtle direction was kind of a tall order that required large work, which requires a lot of time, which requires being in the studio, which when you had to leave New York, I know is certainly problematic. And on top of making the work, then there's always the question of presentation, since paper is such a huge part of what you do. And one of the nice things about studio visits with you is kind of being able to see how you work and seeing how, like, these things can be walked on and kind of scuffed and marked, and you can really get your nose in everything and see the subtlety that glass can sometimes hide. And the time that it would take to build frames these sizes on top of the time that it would take you to make the work became essentially impossible. But you came up with a solution of how to hang them that gave them physical presence and power, but also let the viewers see them fully without the glazing. And that was really nice to see how people responded.
It's also honoring the material. You know, it's paper. I identify them as paintings. The surface is irrelevant to me. I mean, it's the action of painting and thinking like a painter onto the paper as a surface is just what I do. And being forced because of the pandemic to think about presentation and the amount of time we had to get it up on the wall in a formal and respecting the material kind of way, I'm pleased with how it came out.
Yeah.
What did viewers that got to come into the gallery to see the show, how were they responding to the work?
I mean, super positively. Obviously, the large piece, Long Palming, I don't know if we want to cue that up, took everyone's attention as soon as you walk in the door, just based on its scale and its saturation. And Joe, there we go. So this piece is essentially floor to ceiling. It's, I would say, 14 feet long by just under 10 feet high. And I mean, one of the things about back to paper is you don't see a piece of paper this large, like, ever. So kind of, people kind of walk in, recognize it as painting, then step up on it and recognize that it's not just a painting on canvas. And paint sits, I think it's interesting that you say you don't, that the surface is almost arbitrary, but the paint and marks sit so much differently than they do on canvas, which I think is really something that makes your work particularly special. And so watching people kind of like peel back what they were looking at, like you kind of walk in and you're like, oh, big painting. And you're like, wait, this is on paper. Wait, this isn't all one sheet of paper. Oh, I can see these types of marks aren't the same as like painted marks. And that was kind of fun to watch people walk into and then kind of ask this series of questions that was almost predictable by the end.
Yeah.
But my favorite comment is definitely that it looks like Cy Twombly, but fun.
Yeah. Maybe I could talk about process a little bit. Paper is, you know, I've always gravitated towards paper as a surface. I like how it holds my mark. I like how it's kind of the material of the people. You know, it's approachable in terms of how much it costs, and it's easy to get. But it's also the pressure's off because you can toss it to the side if the mark doesn't work. And that allows me to kind of loosen up and relax in studio, which is easier said than done for an artist like me. You know, one of the, I guess, magic tricks of making these things is making them look like they happen very easily. And, you know, we've thrown that term joyful around. These are challenging for me to make. The goal is for it to be joyful to make, but that's not always the case. But I'm doing a lot of cut paper collage. I'm ripping up paintings that weren't feeling right and reinventing them into existing one, you know, on top of others. So there's a Frankenstein sort of recycling thing going on in my studio. And these things grow. I made this kind of like, I think about how a writer might make a sentence. I worked from left to right. And each shape, you kind of see those round worlds, I call them. There's five of them. They all sort of were born out of each other right down the line there. And then the sort of like chaotic noise and gesture above it was kind of, I guess, in my mind, like a thing that was holding them up or suspending them, almost like jewelry or something like that, or flora stuff from a flower petal. Yeah, and it just sort of was very responsive. Each mark kind of was born out of the next and so on and so on.
I mean, it reminds me also, this one in particular reminds me of your last show with us, where press release was basically kind of a diary of your day, where you talk about the frenzy of waking up and getting your kids ready for school and like cleaning fruit and the fruit stickers getting stuck to your shirt and then looking down, and that almost looked like a composition.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm always looking for those intersections between life and art. Life meaning the things that happen in the course of a average day, when you're getting from A to B, when you're brushing your teeth, and noticing those things that happen, those marks, the way that the toothbrush is slopped all over the sink. You know, a lot of this are kind of made from the observed world. You know, I'm not looking at a bowl of fruit and depicting it like a still life painter would, but I'm seeing this sort of like scuff of life and of our kind of ability to get through a day, and using that information to sort of inform the pictures I make. Maybe we could talk about one of the framed drawings too. Can we pull up Embrace Animation?
Yeah.
So I thought it would be nice to talk about these two works, because Long Palming, that big long painting we were just looking at, was the first work I made for the show. And this drawing is the last work that I made for the show. And if I'm going to be forthright, my goal is to make work like this every day I'm in my studio. The reality is it doesn't always work like that. Again, the craft and the magic of making these is it seems like they happen very quickly. But I have to do like 10 to 15 drawings to get one that feels like this one does. So there's an effort in these that doesn't, is maybe a little elusive to see. But the honesty and the immediacy and the way the lines are kind of hitting just so felt really good for me to make.
I would add too that having known you as long as I have, and being someone that's looked at art seriously for the better part of 30 years, there are certain things that you just can't learn. Like, you can learn virtuosic technique and you can learn like conceptual approaches, but kind of a sexy line is just something that you have or you don't have. It's like a physical characteristic in the way that you draw. And I've seen Joe draw the skeleton, and I've seen Joe draw abstraction. And that's part of what makes these sing so much, is just the way that his wrist functions that nobody really does.
Yeah. And I think that comes out of the influences that were around and I kind of grew up with, which include comic books, things that were stylized. You know, my mother had a weekend business doing calligraphy for wedding invitations. And I used to watch her write out these invitations and letterhead things for hours and hours and hours. And I was always really impressed with the sort of like ease and the control and the script and the waywardness of those lines. And I think watching those combined with the things I was looking at as a kid and then moving forward into studying art formally, I really always worked on my line. And I think I can say that it's, you know, it's a foundation for everything I do. Like underneath all my paintings are drawings that look like these, and they just get covered up. In the successful drawings, the ones I don't want to touch stay like this. So these happen in the midst of the big paintings too. Sometimes the big paintings are feeling burdensome to make or stressful, I can always sort of recalibrate myself by making these drawings. This one's fairly big too. It's like 50 inches by 38 inches.
The title is Embrace Animation. How did you come up with that?
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, I just went down a little list of early influences as a young person, comic books, cartoons and animation were one of them. But, you know, I was trying to sort of assign a title to this, which usually happens at the end as opposed to the beginning. And initially I was like, oh, it's kind of like a sequence of a kite taking off or a ball bouncing, being dribbled like a basketball or something like that. Or wait a minute, maybe it's sort of reading like a spine. You know, all these things weren't in my mind when I was making. I was just kind of going instinctually through the mark making process. But then I started to see like a bird's eye view of a person going in for a hug, arms outstretched, like a sequence of someone coming in for a hug or some sort of physical connection. And you know, I can't help but think, because of the pandemic and all the physical distancing, that entered my mind somewhere in there. And that's the title I assigned to this drawing. And it just seemed to fit. You know, I like to put words together that kind of have a prose to them or like a weird, like clunky relationship, but also works. And that might be a metaphor for how I want to make my work too.
I think what my suggestion was thoracic part, which I think you did better than.
Yeah. One more thing we should touch on before we open up to the Q&A is maybe we could talk about why we think it's important, why people should be supporting galleries and artists right now.
For sure. I think, well, it was a really interesting show to kind of grapple with that. In the middle of people sheltering in and kind of getting over the hump of like COVID and putting on an art show, to then watch the biggest social movement that we've seen in our lifetime really opening up in the streets. But we should also mention that one of the things that we did, we decided that it didn't make any sort of statement to not have a show, to just be silent and like let it pass. That it was better to kind of keep making culture, put work out there, give people something that might be a respite from the concerns of the entire world. But we also were able to do a quick fundraiser where we were able to sell 11 works in like 24 hours, that 100% of the proceeds went to three charities that Joseph has worked with closely in the past. Two were in his neighborhood in Red Hook, Brooklyn, and one is a national project called Black Mama's Bailout, the National Bailout. And do you want to talk about the two in your neighborhood real quick?
Well, I think people can get more details if they visit the website. I think for time, maybe. I think it's important to mention that, you know, I had some discomfort about putting on a show and not acknowledging what was going on in the world. And while my work doesn't address themes of injustice directly, I really do believe that art is inseparable from life. And I felt compelled to figure out a way to bring some attention to some organizations that do important work for Black and Brown people. And we were able to raise some money through the sale of art, which is a beginning, a start, an action that I was happy to take on.
That felt great. And it also felt great to be able to open the doors to people, to let them walk in and see the show in person. And for the first time in really a lot of years, the conversation had shifted back to kind of the joy that art brings to people seeing in person. And not to be cynical, but a lot of the conversations around running an art gallery have to do with like investment and where this artist's career trajectory is. And that's all part of this. And like, I'm really proud of the careers that we've helped to build, but it was really nice to see people who had just been inside or like not exposed to culture for so long come in and have like physical reactions to seeing a great art show. And I think that highlighted also what a physical space that hosts art can do for people in terms of like enrichment. And I mean, really at the end of the day, like that's what we're selling. We're selling things that enrich your life that you can and like host for your entire life and then pass on.
Right. The last thing I'll add in this sort of broad question on why we should be supporting galleries and artists, you know, artists, to make art is to be human, and to participate in humanity is to experience art. And I think a lot of us are reflecting on humanity in profound ways right now, considering the pandemic and the shifting ground underneath all our feet. But I wanted to salute that. And I think it's important to contribute to culture and to you know, participate in humanity in that way. And that's something that I've been doing for basically my whole life. And it's something that I think artists and galleries, for that matter, will figure out how to continue to do. And I think collectors and supporters of the arts are going to want to back that too, or should back that. So that's just what I want to say.
Yeah, I mean, essentially we provide a free service, and like your ticket is collecting.
Yeah, yeah. And on that note, maybe we could pivot to the Q&A. I know there's some questions coming in. And
Naomi,
that's why we're here.
All right.
Eliza and I have come back.
Yes.
Hi.
So Eliza, you want to start it off?
I will start off. First of all, thank you both so much. You're both so fluid in the way you talk about the work and about your friendship. And you have that great rapport, which came through in every meeting we'd had leading up to this. And I think was a real treat for everyone. So thank you. But we do have questions. So we'll start, Naomi and I will take turns reading off the questions. The first question is, how has COVID, and it's a question for both of you, affected your process and your work? And so with Ryan, then how does this affect meeting with artists, seeing art, curating shows, thinking about those shows? For Joe, how does working in isolation impact your work, and how is being at home and dealing with children, family, and other distractions come through in that work?
I would say in many ways, the gallery is pretty much programmed just about a year out, generally speaking. So I haven't had to make too many like programming changes, but with Joe's show, probably was the most pressure cooker of like, can we even do this? Can we finish? Will we be allowed to be open? Can we send someone to pick up the work? There were just a lot of logistical things that were hard to answer. And there have been a few artists that I've discovered since I was spending so much time in the computer looking at things. Like, generally artists come to me really organically, but I found a few that would be like cold reach outs, which is pretty unusual for me, but I was taken enough that I'd like to, and I can't do studio visits with them. So there's the talk of like a virtual visit, but so much of doing this is the personal relationship. Like, can you work with this person? Like, not only like the work being great is really step one, and then it really is about like a relationship. And the other thing I would add is the fairs being such a big part of the business, especially being in a place that's kind of remote and destination, it's our best way to reach critical mass at once. And who knows what's going on there? Like, I'm applying to everything as usual, but I don't know how that will be hosted, when, or like, so that's another part that's just interesting to think
about.
We're
working on it.
Yeah, no, I know. But there's no way for anybody to know anything. So the only thing out of the ordinary I did is usually we do a fair in December in Miami, and I applied, and I just kind of left that slot in the gallery open so that if the fair becomes only an online thing, that I can host a physical incarnation of it in the gallery.
Yeah, and then maybe I can just touch on the isolation of the artist. I can only speak for myself and maybe a bunch of other artists, but most artists do work in isolation anyhow. I don't work with assistants, so the being alone and working isn't out of the ordinary for me. What is new is the amount of time I have to be in studio with schools being closed, homeschooling and being a parent and helping our young kids navigate what this all means has really taken priority. So studio process and being in studio and making has become an evening activity or a kitchen table activity for me. I mean, my studio is a 10-minute bike ride from where I live. But part of being an artist is problem solving. So how do I make this type of work in this amount of time in this type of space I find myself in? So it's really just kind of adjusting on the fly to whatever the conditions are for the day and the amount of time I have. And managing expectations too, like making giant work like we saw in the show, which a majority had, were made pre-pandemic and before times. You know, I wonder if I have, you know, emotional space to take on such big projects right now. I probably could get myself there, but you know, there's all these other life things kind of, you know, pulling me in different directions. So that's what I would add to like how COVID is affecting how I'm making right now. There's a lot of things pulling me away from studio right now.
And a lot of things to think about.
I would say that's also kind of a motivator to keep giving artists shows, because if you have a deadline and a thing to work towards, you're more likely to force yourself in there.
Yeah, deadlines are great. I'm best with a deadline. So working towards a show is a big motivator, good goal to have to work towards.
Was getting supplies difficult? And did you have to, like you said, be a problem solver in figuring out different opportunities to get the show together and to get those works of art? I mean, many of them are fairly large scale. Even the smaller paperworks are not insignificant. They're not, you know, like a sheet of paper. So was mm-hmm. that tricky, getting the medium that you needed, all the colors and all of that? What was that like during COVID?
My studio is pretty stocked. I have all the materials I need to make stuff. And I had thankfully, a pretty decent stack of different size sheets of paper to work on. We sort of talked about this in the earlier talk, but the presentation aspect was definitely affected by COVID. Framing couldn't happen because my framer's shop was shut down. So thankfully we had some frames on hand that we could fit into things, but it forced me to think about how to present these large paintings on paper without a frame or without mounting them to, you know, linen and stretching them like a painting, which is sometimes something that I do. So those sorts of problems had to be solved kind of on the fly. And Ryan and I both collaborated on like maybe the best thing to do and workshopped a few ideas, but Ryan, looks like you're going to add something there.
I was going to say that in a way that was kind of freeing, where it feels more like what being in the studio is like. And if it was for an art fair or for a show where we knew we were going to have foot traffic, we just couldn't kind of take the risk to show the work so raw, where usually it has to feel like ready to be like cash the check and have delivered to the collector. But
on the wall. Right.
Yeah. Since we didn't know, like, we knew it would have a huge online presence, but we didn't know if we'd even be able to allow visitors. So it kind of let us be like, well, this is the situation we have. This actually will make the work look great, even if it isn't cash and carry ready. But I don't know. We were able to do a show that I really loved, not because of it, but it was a nice thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think one of the things we said when we got it all up, and I like the next day after we installed, we called and had a conversation about how thrilled and proud we were for pulling this off under the circumstances with everything going on. You know, it felt really good.
Okay. Well, we have actually a lot of questions and they are still coming in, which is great. But I'm going to read the next one. Thank you for hosting this fantastic virtual tour. Big fan of your work, Joseph. You touched upon some of your early influences, comic books, etc. And though your oeuvre has a wide range to it, how would you classify your style? Secondly, because that's an easy question, what are you looking to convey via your works to a spectator? There's clearly an abstract imprint, and I'm wondering whether you want a viewer to interpret it in his or her own way, or whether you're looking to elicit a feeling primordially instead.
Sure. Maybe I'll tackle the second half of that question first. You know, abstraction is such a amorphous, sort of foggy thing. It can mean a lot of different things. And, you know, they do mean things, specific things to me. I think about duality and balance, mm-hmm. how we as people or things can be more than one thing at one time. You know, I want these works to be graceful but awkward, you know, kind of balancing that sweet spot between contrasting sensations. I think that's one of the things I said in the video. But, you know, I want the work to kind of keep viewers on their heels. I want them to feel kind of invited into the work, but also like there's a little bit of danger or uncertainty in there as well, with some of the edges or some of the like spaces in it might feel a little uncomfortable. That's important to me. It's really important for me as I make these things to include some bit of offness, something that's a little off center, a little leaning, like it's going to fall over, but somehow it's holding up. Those sorts of sensations are really important to me because I think, again, they're kind of metaphors for life. I think life is kind of a crooked path and unpredictable, and it can be beautiful one moment and tragic the next. And I think I want to breathe some of that ethos into my paintings. In terms of a style or like how I classify my work, I call it abstraction that really leans into compositional harmony. I want these things to have a visual harmony to them. I want things to land in a certain way and keep the viewer in there searching and returning. I don't know if there's one word to connect to that in terms of style, but those are the things I'm going for.
That kind of leads into the next question. You talk about putting people off balance, and in this pandemic, we're all off balance, right?
Yeah.
But when you're not actually in the gallery looking at these works in person, this actually goes to both of you. There's so much texture, you know, in your works that I don't know that the screen can get that to the viewer. And I don't also know if you're not on a tour like we were able to do today, if you're just looking at works just one-off, how does that presentation shift and change? And what, given this pandemic and knowing that it's not going away anytime soon, how is that going to affect, or how does that affect the purchaser? What kind of questions have you gotten regarding that? And what might be in the future about how galleries are representing these kinds of exhibitions that are really supposed to be seen face-to-face, one-on-one, and with a collective audience?
Yes, it's a constant kind of struggle. The best that we do is just a lot of good documentary photography, but it is something that gets lost. And my personal preference is for things that are particularly tactile, that don't reproduce great on Instagram or on a screen. But that's also part of why I think a gallery is important, where like we have access to so much imagery and so much literature and movies and film and entertainment that functions beautifully on a screen or inside your own mind when you're reading. But what physical objects and paintings can do is something that can't be achieved on a screen. And that's just a reason for making things, but also I think a reason for living with them. And sales-wise, I think it kind of comes down to, even though we've only been open 9 years, people start to trust what you do. People have seen enough things in person that they know I'm not going to show something that I don't think is quality or visually engaging or doesn't reveal something in person that it wouldn't reveal online. And I mean, it's a big thing, even in the amount of like what gets liked the most on Instagram, like you kind of guess based on its like graphic nature versus like what isn't. But even the most graphic artists that I show, there's really wonderful textures in all of their works. I don't know. I hope that answers it. There's a lot there.
I'll just add in real quick. I've done a few FaceTime studio visits where, you know, just going back to technology, you know, the camera, depending on the angle and stuff, and you can get a pretty decent representation of a detail of a painting, particularly one that has texture and material built up on it. So that's been very, very useful for me. And the other added layer of a FaceTime studio visit or meeting, for that matter, when you're talking about visual art and you can use the camera in real time, is the artist or the gallerist can talk about the work and provide a little bit more context. And I think, like we're doing now, that's beneficial. You know, I can try and find a story for days to communicate what that texture feels like a wet field or something at 5 a.m. on a August night, you know, like something kind of ridiculous like that might sometimes work. But talking to artists, whether on the phone or in these virtual settings, is, I think, a nice stopgap.
You'll become a poet.
Yeah.
Our next question. Joe, tell us about your podcast. How does that tie into your art?
Sure. So it's called Deep Color, and it's an oral history project and podcast that focuses on conversations with artists and arts professionals. I've been doing it for 4 years. And it's really kind of me going into artists' studios with a really big like bag full of curiosity and asking questions about how things are made and what they're thinking about and you know, things in their life and biography that, you know, going back to context, sort of like helped me understand a work of art. It's really turned into an extension of my studio practice. You know, art for me, a big part of art for me is sharing knowledge and learning. And going into an artist's studio and asking them questions in the way that we're doing now and recording it and sharing it with other people, I find incredibly enriching and rewarding. And I learn things about myself and my own artwork through other people. And it really has sort of has added a layer of knowledge, again, over what I do in my studio. It's been a wonderful project and revelatory in so many ways, both in terms of meeting new artists and getting to see new work behind the scenes in studios, but also just getting information out there. There's a vastness to how a podcast gets distributed, whereas a static work of art is just in one place at one time. You know, this goes back to this whole technology and How do we see work in person? A podcast has a global reach immediately at no cost. And that's been a really wonderful way to connect with other artists and other art lovers and arts enthusiasts. It's been an important little project that I didn't think would last this long.
Well, I think we're at about time to wrap this up. So I really wanted to thank you both for bringing us into the gallery, bringing us into your minds, bringing us into your souls, and how COVID has altered, changed for the better, for the worse. But just in general, it's really exhilarating to hear about the work and hear about the logistics and to hear about all the positive that go on in this new dynamic. I also really need to thank the Armory Show team and Eliza and her crew. We've been working with them now for 4 years, I think.
4 years.
Yeah. And it's been just a wonderful, wonderful partnership. And we look forward to doing more. I wish both of you great luck. I would love to go through your gallery and hear your poetic licenses about your textures, because I think they inspire me. Both of you have a great rest of the week and weekend. And we look forward to seeing what else is going to be going on at the Halls McKay Gallery. Again, Ryan, if you just want to say one more time how people can get to you and what times you're open before we leave, I think that would be great.
For sure. And if I could just say one thing about Joe doing the podcast, he and other artists that we show have projects that are like publishing companies, or they put out records, or they have itinerant curatorial projects. And that's something that I find very interesting, because in the end, every artist is kind of alone, and the market can kind of come and go, and it does for everyone. But when you're really building cultural capital, I think that has like long value. And artists that have these projects that contribute, as much as being an artist is so much about you and your show and your career, but when you have something else going on, I think that gives everyone a chance for historical relevance and community. And that's just something that I always look for. And to find us, it's just halseymckay.com. I'm Ryan at halseymckay.com. And we're open Fridays through Mondays, 11 to 5 in East Hampton, New York.
Great. And thank you, audience, for joining us. We really are appreciative of your time, and we hope you enjoyed it as much as we have. Have a good day, everyone.
Thanks. Stay safe.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.